Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production. The term company store is an anachronism. They don't really exist much anymore. But in the heyday of one factory towns or one industry communities, they were everywhere. Being the only retailers anywhere nearby, and definitely the only ones that accepted vouchers or employee scripts or offered credit, gave them a massive advantage. A local monopoly, you might even say. They were often the villains in the story of the community, and the songs from that period make it very clear.
St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
So when Canadians, including our guest today, call Loblaw Companies Canada's company store, they're not quite being literal. I mean, for one thing, Loblaw doesn't accept scripts or vouchers, just optimum points. And Loblaw stores are not, in fact, the only game in town. If you choose not to spend your money with the company, there are other places to get your groceries and medication and everything else. Maybe there aren't as many options as you would like, but they're out there. The reason, though, that the term company store fits this mammoth corporation led by the Weston family is because of how dominant the company's brands and subsidiaries have become. They are literally everywhere. They sell literally everything. And every time you blink, they are opening a new store, they are acquiring a competitor, or they are moving in to a new line of business. And when Loblaw moves into a new line of business, they're very good at crowding out the competition. So how did the Weston's empire become so omnipresent in this country? How did it go from a single grocery store more than 100 years ago to hundreds of thousands of employees, thousands of storefronts, dozens of subsidiaries, and billions of dollars in profit? And what has that done to us along the way? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. David Moskrop is a writer, a political commentator, and an author. The book is called Too Dumb for Democracy, and his latest piece explores the long and storied history of how Loblaw came to own half of Canada, David?
That's right. Yeah, that became the company store for the world's second largest by landmass country.
Why don't we start right there with context? Loblaw's been around for quite some time. When did they form and how did they grow? Like, what was their big concept that started this company on the road to dominance?
So Loblaw is a little bit impressive. I mean, people reading the story might come away thinking, wow, this guy's just a hater. But let's give it up to them for a second here. They opened roughly 100 years ago, 1919, with this idea that, well, we're going to do self-serve cash and carry grocery. So instead of a clerk going to fetch everything for you and prep everything for you, and they'd go deliver it down the road by horse and wagon or whatever, we're going to do what became the market and later supermarket. And they sort of innovate this concept, or are part of the innovation of this concept through the 20th century, which is sort of impressive and innovative. And that's the origin of this organization that now has become an everything company.
Let's keep it to groceries for just one second, because obviously that's where they started and what they're known for. How much of that market in this country do they control right now?
They are the largest in the country. They account for, in 2022 anyway, 29% of the market share, give or take. And that shows no sign of seriously abating. So roughly a third of the market.
And beyond that, the reason we're talking today is because your piece for The Walrus calls them an everything company. And you wrote that Loblaw wants your dollars from cradle to grave.
So walk us through what everything is. What does dollars from cradle to grave look like? What do they own?
Well, let's get a sense of scale. And this isn't some hidden trove of facts that I had to go dig for. This is literally listed on the company's website.
They're proud of this, and they should be, I guess.
Well, this is what their shareholders want. And if the goal of the company is to grow endlessly, this is what you want to do. 90% of Canadians live within 10 kilometers of one of their locations. 18 million people are part of the PC Optimum program. 3 million people hold a PC MasterCard. They employ 190,000 people, give or take. They process something like 2 billion transactions a year. So that's the scale. They own, in terms of different types of businesses, obviously grocers, including Provigo, Zehrs, Fortino's, Independent, Real Canadian Superstore, No Frills, Maxi, TNT, Shoppers, Drug Mart, which is also now the groceries, and of course, Loblaws. And on top of that, they have Shoppers Drug Mart and Pharmaprix. They have for-profit clinics and medical businesses. They have a real estate investment trust. They have clothing by way of Joe Fresh. They're in beauty, they're in wireless, and they're in financial service. On top of owning the brands that you probably have in your cupboard, as I say, President's Choice, No Name, Joe Fresh, and Life. So that gives you the sense of the scale and the reach of this corporate octopus.
You almost ran out of breath doing that.
Yeah, I train as like a Navy SEAL would train to draw that breath out to go through all of Loblaw's considerable holdings.
How did they manage to gather so many brands and categories, everything from clothes to groceries to banking? How did they practically accomplish something like that?
Well, sort of in the way that successful companies do that, at least did that in the last century, they started with a good idea and a lot of hard work. I'm talking in the sort of early part of the 20th century. They parlayed that as long as they could by opening up chains. And one of the early approaches of Loblaw was chain stores. And so that gives them a big leg up. They faced tumultuous times. Obviously, they lived through the Depression. They went through the war years, the post-war years. They slumped in the 1960s. This is when the Westons become seriously involved, Galen Weston Sr. They come in and they then start doing the supermarket, hypermarket, chain conglomerate thing where they start hoovering up other companies, right? They didn't launch Shoppers Drug Mart. They bought Shoppers Drug Mart, right? They're hoovering things up.
Right.
So they've been, you know, accumulating capital, accumulating capacity, buying up people, strategically entering into industries, the health industry, the beauty industry, obviously the grocery industry, the finance industry, the real estate industry. And as they go, they've gotten quite good. And I take this from Vass Bednar, who runs an excellent Substack called Regs to Riches. I learned a lot from her throughout this process by getting really good at data and collecting information on folks and marketing and understanding the digital space very, very well. So they've combined this capacity to grow and to expand with deep market savviness and penetration into essential markets and now sit in a position in the Canadian market where they seem to be unstoppable and unbreakdownable.
How usual or unusual is that approach of hoovering up everything and expanding into so many different lines of business? And if it's not that unusual, is Loblaw just better at it or were they first at it or what? Because not everybody might try this, not everybody reaches this kind of dominance.
No, it's not uncommon for companies to integrate vertically, horizontally, to poke into other markets, especially in a country like Canada, where oligopoly and monopoly is fairly common, particularly in, you know, the airline industry, the grocery industry, the telecom industry, and so forth, the banking industry, obviously. Mm-hmm. So it's not uncommon at all. It's also common in the United States. It is a problem. And it is a common occurrence. But I do think that Loblaw is particularly good at it. And I say good in the sense of effective. I think it's economically and morally deeply suspect and problematic. But in terms of someone being very, very good at something, they're very, very good at this. There was a period in the 60s and into the 70s where the company was in rotten shape and could have fallen apart. And among others, Galen Weston Sr. turned it around. So it wasn't preordained. The company could have failed. But through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, 2010s, they got very, very good at understanding marketing, understanding data collection, and strategically entering new markets. And some of those are little things. Remember the Insider's report and Dave Nickel on the front of the Insider's report?
Right.
That was a wildly effective, sharp marketing technique. Now you parlay that into the digital age where they've got the PC Optimum app and points system that collects massive amounts of data, can micro-target ads to you, can, in theory, coordinate that data with other points of data they collect elsewhere, and they get a good sense of who the consumer is. And so they're not just a grocery store. In fact, the grocery store is at best the tip of the spear. They're a deep data marketing operation. And in fact, to go back to Vass Bednar says they sort of resemble Amazon in 2012, which I think is such a good way to put it.
When you look at something like this, particularly in a country like Canada, what kinds of issues can this all-out dominance across categories lead to? This is a company, particularly in recent years, that is no stranger to, scandal, outrage, etc.
Yeah, well, there are a few different angles to look at this from. One is the consumer angle. And then we say, well, look, if one company controls all of these chains and brands, outlets, we risk them dominating the market and raising prices. There's no competition, and so they have the capacity to control prices, control margins, squeeze suppliers, squeeze consumers. And so we get a worse experience and higher costs for consumers. That's problem one. Problem two is labor. They also have a capacity to crush labor, to dictate terms, right? They fought against a living wage. That gives them an awful lot of power to try to keep labor wages down because they make more money that way, right? Lower your costs, which makes life harder for laborers. So that's point two. And point three, they become a profoundly strong lobbying outlet as well. And say they want to push, let's say, the further privatization or rise of for-profit healthcare in this country and dismantle public healthcare, which so many Canadians value, even though it's deeply strained right now, then they have the capacity to do that, particularly as they control significant segments of that market.
Let's talk about this then from the government point of view or from Loblaw's point of view. Why has this company been allowed to accumulate this kind of market dominance? Like, given everything you've just explained and what it can lead to, what's the argument for governments allowing Loblaw to do this?
Well, I don't think there's any argument, no cogent one, but they're going to make them the way that every company makes them, which is some combination of, well, it's more efficient. Efficiencies is a favorite of monopolists and oligopolists. Better for the consumer. It's a one-stop shop, right? You got your PC Optimum app. You can use it at Shoppers. You can use it at Real Canadian Superstore or Loblaws or whatever it might be. You go get your groceries on the way out. You stop at the bank. You pick up a cell phone. Maybe you get your blood pressure checked and you pick up your medication. And isn't that great? On the other hand, the government is just incapable or unwilling or both to actually harness the power of the state to limit or to undo monopoly. As I say in the piece, we're very slow to prevent monopolies. And once they form, we say there's sort of nothing we can do about it. And while the Competition Bureau is sort of coming alive in recent years, it's been stagnant for a long time and hasn't really been able to do what it's meant to do, which is promote and preserve competition. The federal government now is trying to introduce some competition. It's trying to push back. But it's a tall order, and it's going to take a lot more than what the Liberals are doing right now, which is trying to introduce a foreign competitor, and getting the grocers to sign onto a voluntary code of conduct.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Is it that the government is truly unable, or are they unwilling? What options are on the table if the Liberal government or whomever forms the next government actually wanted to tackle the idea of considering Loblaw a monopoly?
If the government wins and they're very, very serious about doing something about it, whether it's a conservative government or a liberal government. A voluntary code of conduct that normalizes relations between suppliers and retailers isn't going to do it. Introducing Aldi, you know, from Germany as a new competitor isn't going to do it. They have to look at this conglomerate and say, no, it's a problem that for which we need to reach into the roots. Because it's not just about groceries. And to the extent that we focus merely on groceries, we're missing the broader threat of a company that aims to control large segments of multiple markets. And we got to break it up. They got a forced divestiture, which is a big old swing, but a necessary one. And it's going to take a government with a lot of capital and a lot of guts and say, no, I'm sorry, you can't own 12 different grocery brands. You can't own intersecting industries. You can't own a massive data hoovering operation that coordinates within your broader ecosystem. It's bad for the consumer. It creates a power imbalance politically and economically, and we're going to break you up if you don't divest yourself. You know, this can be done in theory and in practice. It's been done in the past. The US right now is threatening to do it to ByteDance with TikTok. We may have to follow suit, as many as say. So it can be done. It's just going to take a lot of political courage and a lot of guts beyond that, and a hell of a fight in the courts and in the court of public opinion.
You mentioned Galen Weston Sr., the Weston family, inextricably now, I think, in Canadians' minds, linked with Loblaw. At the center of it is Galen Weston Jr., I guess. And I want to ask you, you know, who is he? And maybe more importantly, is he the bad guy here? Is he the guy making these decisions? Or is he like the face of the brand and, you know, the guy Canadians blame because grocery prices are high and their point system is everywhere tracking their data and all the other things we've just discussed?
Well, let's start here. He's remarkably good at what he does. I mean, he remains in the company even though he's stepped back as CEO. He's generated a lot of value for the company. He's grown it considerably. I mean, if we're looking and doing an imminent internal critique and assessment of the company, he's wildly successful and capable.
Right.
But, you know, the economist Jim Stanford called him the poster boy for supermarket excess. And that's in part because during the pandemic, when things were getting extraordinarily expensive and everyone was terrified all the time, we were, you know, sandblasting our groceries and quarantining our mail, and we couldn't afford anything, and the price of food was going through the roof and still through the roof, he went and stuck his face out and, you know, wearing yellow sweaters, playing the avuncular figure.
Yeah.
And at precisely the wrong time, you know, they attempted to put a more inviting face on the industry. And that was precisely the wrong move because people were angry. And so he became the target and the lightning rod. Because you'll notice that Loblaw gets a lot of the focus, particularly on grocery, but they're not the only mega chain, right? Mm-hmm. It's part of the problem is you don't like Loblaw. What are you going to do? You're going to go shop at Sobeys. Well, welcome to the other conglomerate ecosystem, right?
Right.
But he really stuck his neck out. Also, they remain the biggest in the country. So they do have a place as the sitting on the throne, right? And so when people look to dethrone the king, well, there's the king. But the problem isn't inherently simply Galen Weston. It's a whole corporate ecosystem that has shareholders, right? Mm-hmm. And stakeholders and the state for that matter, and executives and employees and lots of people down on the line. It's not just about Galen Weston, but he became the poster child for it. And so when people are looking around saying, I want to blame someone because I'm mad about this hero pay being rescinded. I'm mad about the bread price fixing scandal. I'm mad about this idea for Manulife to only cover certain drugs at Shoppers. I'm mad about them reducing this 50% discount for expiring food to 30%. Who do I look to? I'm like, oh, there's Big Daddy Galen over here. He's the one.
That was a good list, by the way, that you just gave me of recent scandals and reasons why people are pissed at this company.
I've been living with it for a while.
Yeah, I bet. Has any of that actually hurt Loblaw? What's their public reputation like now? And like, honestly, given everything else we've talked about and the money at stake here, do they care? Are they invested in changing it?
I think they do care. Corporations have a bottom line, and they have, you know, a line item called goodwill. They have an intangible brand value, and they don't like to be hated, and they don't like to be hauled in front of the House of Commons to answer for grocery prices going up.
Right.
Shareholders don't like that either, right? So obviously they do care about that. They backed off on the Manulife thing. They backed off on reducing the discount for expiring foods, for instance, so that they can be shamed into backing off. That said, you know, their fourth quarter results were $14.53 billion in revenue and $541 million in profit.
Huh.
Their margins are healthy. Their profit is healthy. They're doing fine. And that's part of the issue here is, where are you going to go? If you're angry at Loblaws, where are you going to go? You might have very few options, right? You might be bound up in their ecosystem and we're like, well, yeah, but I need the points. I want the points. I get to redeem my points. It's right down the road. All my stuff is already at Shoppers. What am I going to do? Does it really matter because the prices are so similar elsewhere? If I go to Sobeys instead of Loblaws, same damn difference. I'm stuck here. And so they care in a sense, but in the other sense, they're doing fine despite all of the anger, even though they've become far less trusted. Their rankings in trust have gone down, so on and so forth. But when you're an oligopoly, where are people going to go? You're the company's store. Where else are they going to go?
I live right near a No Frills. And it's the only supermarket in the area. However, recently, competition for No Frills opened up right next door to it, giving me some choice.
Was it a Zares?
It was a Shoppers Drug Mart.
Yeah. Someone on the internet said that Shoppers Drug Mart was surge pricing for Loblaws, which I thought was just one of the most astute comments I've ever seen. Because look, I mean, I am part of this group who is sort of stuck in this ecosystem insofar as we have a Loblaws down the road. If I'm walking back from the coffee shop, I'm passing a Shoppers and you got to grab some milk. I don't often drive. I typically walk places. So I go to Shoppers and grab milk, but it's a dollar more expensive, right?
Also, when you go to Shoppers, you're sometimes not feeling so well. So you really can't be bothered to make an extra step to get something cheaper.
Well, but this is part of it too, right? That gets you in the door. And then all of a sudden everything's there. This is part of the efficiencies argument. And that's pretty sharp stuff. You know, we all remember going to convenience stores and paying way more money for a can of soup or a carton of milk or a bag of milk back in the day because it was convenient. We had to.
Right.
Now this is effectively Loblaws has scaled that up to the level of dominating the country. It's, again, it's wildly impressive as a corporate strategy, deeply, deeply, deeply deleterious to the country in all kinds of ways, but they're very good at this.
Well, this is the last thing I want to talk about because it can seem like there's not a lot of options for people who, A, to your point, don't want to engage with the ecosystem, but also B, even somebody who recognizes this as a problem and is listening to this podcast or has talked about Loblaw with other people and is furious, you've already outlined that we would need a government willing to take a big swing. And you use terms like have guts. And does any political party in Canada seem like that to you right now, willing to take action, take on the Western Empire? Like, people might love to vote their way out of this. Who do you vote for?
No one. I don't look at any political party in this country right now and think that they either have the will or the competence to pull this off. I don't think we can vote our way out of this right now. And we can't vote with our dollars either because there's almost nowhere to go.
So what do we do?
There isn't all that much we can do at the moment beyond pressuring our politicians to come up with a better plan for dealing with monopoly and oligopoly and ensuring affordability while protecting labor rights, wages, and the healthcare system, the public healthcare system. We can lobby for these things. We can organize for these things. And people are doing that work. Unions are doing that work. Activists are doing that work. We can support them. So there are little things, well, actually, there are significant things we can do, but there's no single weak point that we say, okay, we're going to focus all our attention here. No, it's you got to support unions and unionization. You got to support activists who are doing better. If you can shop somewhere else, especially local, small business and so on and so forth, do that. Do vote and vote for the parties that are going to be best on this. Pressure the political parties to do that too, because ultimately it's going to take a political decision. But right now it's a tall order. It's a tough fight and we're on the losing end of it because again, to go back to the government's current action, there's at least something happening, right? They're trying to get a code of conduct through, voluntary as it is. They're trying to introduce a little bit more competition, although that's going to be a foreign conglomerate, which is, you know, better in a sense, but it misses a bigger problem. Mm-hmm. And no one's advancing a program that is comprehensive and effective. But I do think if we keep pushing, we keep talking and building and waiting for a moment, that moment may arise. And I do think when we're trying to agitate for change, as Christopher Pratt, the great painter, put it to me years ago when I interviewed him, luck should find you at work. He was paraphrasing Picasso. Luck should find you at work. So we do the work, we keep talking about this, we keep pushing for better, and when the moment comes, we strike and we wait for luck to find us at work, but we keep doing that work as we wait, and that's probably our best chance.
David, thank you for this. I will point out at the end of this interview, because you knew I was going to do this, that if you look David Moskrop up online or go buy his book, you will be struck by the resemblance to Galen Weston, which is perfect. It's the perfect coda for this.
I changed my profile picture on Twitter to one of Galen Weston because I thought it was funny, and but my partner is making me change it back.
There's only a few billion differences between you and he.
Well, together, we're worth billions.
David, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
David Moskrop writing about Loblaw for The Walrus. That was The Big Story. For more, you can head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can, as always, offer us feedback. The way to do that is by emailing us, hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca, or just giving us a call and leaving a voicemail, 416-935-5935. We've got a feedback episode featuring all of your emails and voicemails coming this Friday, so stay tuned for that. Featuring, of course, the many opinions we got on bagged milk. The Big Story is available in every single podcast player and on your smart speaker. Just ask it to play The Big Story podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.